This is Wage War, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org. and www.acornradio.org. Podcasts will be available to the show on these websites and affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today we're talking to Professor Gerard de Geest, who is at the Washington University School of Law in St. Louis and is a professor of international and comparative law. But what brings him on our show? There's a fascinating book he's written called Rent, How Marketing Causes Inequality. Welcome to Wade's World, Professor de Geest.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, as I warned you, first we better explain, but when we're talking about rents, we're not talking about the high rents that tenants are paying. We're talking about something different, aren't we?
Yeah, indeed. We talk about artificial profits. So rents was a term coined by Ricardo 200 years ago. And he talks about rents that is an artificial profit that would not be possible under conditions of perfect competition. And the biggest example he had in mind was rents for landlords. So he took that word. But economically, rent indeed means something else than what a landlord receives from a tenant. So it is a profit, but also, under perfect competition, there should be some profits. Otherwise, businesses would not survive. But it's a profit that goes beyond what is needed to stay alive. And so it's a profit that you see on oligopoly or monopoly type of markets.
And your estimate is that these rents, these artificial profits, are a huge part of our economy.
Yeah, indeed. I think I estimate conservatively that it's about 35%. That's a lot indeed. So it means if you, as an American, you spend $100, on average you overpay by $35. So you spend $100, and of that is $65 for the service itself, for the good itself. But $35 is actually an artificial profit. That would not be possible in a perfectly competitive market.
Well, we're proving that we don't live in a perfectly competitive market, obviously, but this is a situation that your book argues has gotten worse over the last 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, indeed. So I do calculate some figures, and it is in 1970, it was about 20%. So we've moved from 20% of artificial profits to 35% over the time span of four decades, 1970 till 2010. I do a lot within the year 2010 because we have the best figures, the best data around that. But it has increased from 20% to 35%, and that's a huge difference.
Which, in your argument, and I think in the experience of most of all of us, and certainly a lot of our listeners, that's a huge part of why so much of our resources have stuck to the rich and why inequality is such a gnawing issue everywhere.
Yeah, indeed. So in itself, the 35% does not say who gets them, but I do develop rent economics. And the law number one of rent economics was formulated by Ricardo 200 years ago. And that is that rents go to the owner and not to the one who's doing the job. So the rents at this time associated with the best land. Suppose you have the best land. So you as a farmer, you do some effort, but you get more than what other efforts than what other farmers do. Well, who gets that? Is that the farmer who works on it? And Ricardo says, no, the law is it goes to the owner. So if the farmer is a tenant, it will go to the landlord. And that's the same with rents in a modern economy. So if HP sells you printers that only work with HP cartridges for ink, who gets that? And then HP can charge you $39 or $29 for something that would normally cost $5. So who gets that artificial profit? Well, it are the owners of HP, the shareholders, and then specifically also the first generation shareholders.
And this is a situation that, I mean, you give numerous examples in your book as well about one of the ones I thought was most interesting is you cite a lawsuit that as an example, I think maybe it's one that you use in your classes where a company essentially, in what most of us would call a fraudulent effort, convinces a landowner to see if there's some natural resource on their property for a small amount. And, hey, if we find it, we'll give you XYZ, 10%. And they already knew that it was likely that there was a resource. I mean, why don't you remember the example I'm talking about?
Yeah. So that's the Kit Creek mine, although there are two points to be said about it. It's a case where you have in the traditional framing, you have an entrepreneur. So they do research and they find out that there is a high likelihood of mineral deposits in a place in Ontario, in Canada. And then they have to, according to property law in Canada, in that state, they have to, or the mine goes to the one who has the land above it. And then they basically go to the owner and says, you know, owner, we know nothing about your land, but we're willing to do a free survey. And if we find something, you get 10%. And the owner then accepts that. But it's a double. On the one hand, we say it should not be that company that gets the money. But I think there is a more deeper, there is a deeper tragedy. And that is that mines and oil and so has a value. And it should not go to just owners. It should basically be auctioned at the moment when there is more information about it. So I think it's not a good rule to say that oil belongs to the one who has land above it. Because just imagine, even if it goes to that farmer, it was about $1 billion. So that farmer would have been $1 billion richer.
Well, and I think your argument is that it's a natural resource that citizens themselves have an investment in too, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, for natural resources, that's a very specific type of rents. But you have two choices. You know, you have the Norway choice where it's owned by the government and where the rents go to the government and the government can then lower taxes or do some good things with it, like pension funds for all Norwegians. That is one model. The other model is the Texas model, where the one who gets the oil can keep it, and so where it's basically privatized. And I've argued that the Texas model is basically organizing lotteries to people who just happen to live above a natural resource and who get it then. And then at the other side, some oil investors who have to outsmart and the owners and try to get a hold on their oil. And I think the Norwegian model is better from an income inequality perspective because eventually the billions, they go to all people and not just to a couple who are just lucky to have oil underneath their land.
Yeah, it's just they wake up one day and find out, and these stories, as you say, of Texas millionaires, overnight millionaires in the oil booms, whether it was around East Texas or, other areas, are just legendary in the United States.
But why
is there not more concern? I mean, this is probably a deeper question, but why is there not more concern about these artificial profits? Because clearly the ideology in the country is that, we're running a free economy and competition is important, but from your research, we're just, the actual reality is so different.
Yeah, that's a deep question. I think there is something linked to American culture that does not work well in this case. So it's good and bad. So in the United States, if you make money, then people will say, congratulations, you must have done something fantastic and you deserve it. If in France, you say that you made a lot of money, they'll say, hey, you must have cheated, because otherwise you cannot have so much money. And the good thing about American culture is that it encourages real entrepreneurship also. Right? So if you're an entrepreneur, you're a hero and you can keep the money. It's not taxed away completely. And in France, it's much more difficult to be an entrepreneur. So that's good about the United States. But the same ideology makes it easier to fool Americans than to fool French people. So if you overcharge an American, the American will think, oh, you know, I paid $300 for a plumber. That's probably how much it costs. While a French who has to pay 300 euro for a plumber will say, hey, this is too much. You do something that you fool me. So you see the same optimism and the same idea that if you make money, you deserve it, is good and it's bad. But when it comes to income inequality, it's bad because basically Americans are not critical enough about what they see. Yeah, even if they see artificial profits in front of their eyes, many will not believe that it are artificial profits. And that's one of the reasons why marketeers have an easier job in the United States than they have in France.
Well, it's also why the United States is now one of the most unequal countries and economies in the world. We're talking to Professor Garrett DeGeest, who's a professor in St. Louis at Washington University, about a book he recently wrote called Rents, How Marketing Causes Inequality. Let's look at marketing. Now, clearly we've established that there's a lot of artificial profits, but part of the core argument of your book is that part of this is flim-flam from marketing, that business schools have sort of dominated the way we think here.
Yeah. So the question is what causes the increase of inequality.
Exactly. And how does marketing, how in your argument does marketing end up wearing such a black hat?
Yeah. Well, maybe I should give a couple of examples.
Exactly.
So I've given the example of the ink. So you pay maybe $29 for your ink that works with your HP printers, but the true cost will be $5, and you pay $29. Now, what does this have to do with marketing? Well, what happened here is that HP, that they applied, or that the marketeers applied, one of the many tricks that they teach you at the business school. It is called the razor blade model, and it tells marketeers that they should make the razor cheap and the blade expensive. So it tells that the printer should be cheap and then the ink should be expensive. And if you do that you can make artificial profits. That is that was discovered when they observed Gillette with their razor and their blades. Sometimes the razor was expensive, sometimes the blade was expensive. And they discovered empirically that if the blade is expensive, you can make some artificial profits. So if you think it's coincidence that the HP, that they have this model, it's no coincidence. It's a generally applied model that they teach students at business school. If you take another example, just imagine that you have a product and it costs $3. And next to it on the shelves, you put another product that costs $10, about three times more. But it's exactly the same. Nobody would buy the one of $10, right? But exactly. So what does Bayer do? Okay, they have aspirin costs $3, and then they say the next is Bayer, so they give a brand name to it, and then suddenly some people started to pay the $10 because they think that there is a difference, while there is no difference. So this is also one of the tricks of business schools, where they say you have to distribute using different brands. And then some people will pay the higher value brands. So these are two examples where marketers enter the scene, and suddenly people pay more, or at least some people pay more for the same. And I've gone through maybe 100 anecdotes And right now, you can say that the majority of all the markets have been influenced by marketeers at some point. So if you just look at what you pay, maybe you hired a plumber and the price for the plumber itself was reasonable, but maybe you paid a $29 for a bolt that was, they made to believe you that it is a special bolt, but it's a bolt that should cost a dollar, and they charge $29. Well, this is basically what marketeers do. And they look at prices, they look at, well, the bolt will be distributed in one brand to Home Depot and then in another version directly to plumbers so that you cannot even compare that is the same. So marketeers, the positive view on marketing until now was that marketeers, they do good things because they just bring good products in front of people. And in my view, marketeers largely do the opposite. They try to distort markets by using certain tricks basically to fool people, and this way they distort markets, because in distorted markets profits can be higher. So distorted markets, that can be a market where there is no full information, but can also be where there is a lock-in effect or something else that makes competitive forces go away.
Could one argue that this whole modern, I mean, certainly in the last number of years, people talk about branding in a different way than they did, say, 30 years ago. Is the whole notion of branding pretty much something we could boil down to artificial profits or rents?
It's very closely related. So there is also something positive about brands. That is, it gives information on the quality. But largely, it comes at the expense of price distortion. So in marketing literature, they typically say that whenever a good is a brand, you can charge 15% more. And so brands, they have a good function. Let's say Apple, when you see Apple, you know that the quality of the phone will be high. But it distorts then at the price level. So usually whenever you buy a brand, you pay too much. And so brands, they solve one problem, a quality problem, a little bit, at the expense of basically an income inequality problem, because you overpay, and so some people will receive that money, and there you have the income inequality. So it's not a good solution to quality. A better solution would be that you, as a consumer, have full information about, you know, what's the quality of the product, so that there would be some quality stamps, quality certification. That would be a better way.
Well, I mean, you've hit on a pet peeve of mine. I don't buy any Apple products if I can help it, because I remember when the Apple phone came out, and all the reviews you can say about information were that it actually didn't work well as a telephone. You know, as a status symbol, I would be in India, or I would be in so many other countries, and you could tell somebody was really, something if they had an Apple phone at that kind of price point. But I also worked a million years ago, literally almost 50 years ago, at a coffee company here in New Orleans. And what was interesting to me is it was a well-known brand here in New Orleans called Louisiane, but it had a number of contracts with grocery companies and a huge contract at that time with the U.S. military. And it would produce exactly the same coffee at different price with another name, And anytime you go into a grocery store and see a store branded item that's competing as coffee or mustard or whatever it may be, President's Choice or whatever, that's frequently the same kind of thing as your Bear example, isn't it? People are paying to say it's Louisiane, but they may be paying, $2 less a pound of coffee if it's, called blah, blah, blah.
So it's a way of making more profits, but it's basically based on fooling people, on basically tricking some people who don't have full information. Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. So many, many years ago, I worked as a student in a grocery store in Belgium.
Okay.
And every week there was the product of the week, and so I had to put that product in the middle of the aisle, And then I said, hey, don't I have to change the price indication now? And they said, no, it's the same. It's the same price because people think if it's the product of the week that is cheaper, it's not cheaper, but they buy it more for the same price.
And so it was also,
okay, that was 40 years ago. Now, at that time, it was an exception that a grocery store was run by marketeers, but now it's just most grocery stores are run like this. So it is,
But it's not a situation where we do have. Information, you argued, was important. I mean, in those cases, nobody has any information necessarily about what company is producing that product that may have a different name than the name of the brand we're familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's basically the goal of marketing to keep that a secret.
We've got a problem here on these artificial profits. We're talking to Professor DeGeest out of Washington University about a book he wrote called Rents, How Marketing Causes Inequality, which I'm not sure all of you will go out to read, but I think you should because it's fascinating in explaining our situation. What in the world do we do, Professor DeGeest? I mean, part of what you argue is that law could be a stronger argument for change here than just, redistribution through taxes. So let's get into some of your policy recommendations and some of the things that you don't think will work.
Yeah. So, well, I give a whole long list, but a simple measure would be to create a duty to publish prices on the internet in a standardized form. So let roofing companies, let them publish their price lists, their complete price lists on the internet in the standardized form. So then you could immediately see if plumbers overcharge you for bowls. Let lawyers publish their price list also on the internet. Make it more general. Whenever you are in the economy and you offer some services, you offer some products, there should be a duty to publish price information just on the internet. Now, that's just a simple measure, but that could do a lot for many reasons. It would be harder to fool people to pay $29 for a bolt if exact information is given about those prices in the internet. So the internet could immediately discover it if something is overpriced.
Would that help us in the grocery store examples you and I have given?
It would help indirectly in the sense that in that case, apps could immediately tell you, hey, don't pay $10 for something. You also can buy the same at $3, right? Of course, that's somewhat linked also to quality information. But the question is, if you buy Bayer aspirin, why isn't there an app that tells you, hey, don't buy Bayer, just buy the CVS, buy the Walgreens, that's way cheaper? Well, partly is because those who make apps, they don't have access to that information.
That's a whole, we have a huge problem here, as you know, in the United States between, people who buy a brand versus generic drugs. And this is a political fight as well. How pharmacists are able to give you generic drugs was not always the case. I mean, pharmaceutical companies fight that tooth and nail. But how can law help do this? I mean, part of what you argued in, if you looked at redistribution, is that many people, and certainly politicians and others, argue that you can redistribute some of this money to achieve more equality through taxes. And you argue that that's actually not the best case.
Yeah, so if you tax, then you tax hard work also. And some people, they have a high income because just hard work and because of true productivity. And some others, they have it because of, rents, basically, artificial profits.
Yeah, right.
And if you tax the same, so let's say you have two plumbers, they both have a double income, but one does it by working 80 hours per week, and the other does it by fooling people to pay too much for spare parts. The tax system does not know who is who. And so if we tax all plumbers with a double income, then we don't make the distinction. So it's better to attack the problem at the cause, and the cause are those artificial profits. And so I've argued in the book that if you look at them, it's basically all can be attacked by extending legal doctrines in a certain way. For instance, the Pint example, if we extend the monopolization definition a little bit in antitrust law, we can attack that. So the idea is, if marketing really distorts markets, and if law stops distorting the markets, then we just need more law to make those strategies impossible.
Well, and do you think there's any chance of that?
That's a good question. Yeah. The question is, will we ever see it during our lives?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. There's arguments back and forth, for example, even around the antitrust legislation we have now, that there has not been, I mean, the huge rise of Silicon Valley companies, Amazons and, Googles and Facebooks or whatever, sort of confronts, antitrust regulations in those ways. We're not even using the tools we have now.
Yeah, that is right. But that's a difficult question. So, but I think at the Republican side, the ideology is that they like hard work, and that they feel that if you work hard, you should be able to keep what you make. And in my proposal, that will be the case. And then from the Democratic side, they like taxes because it's a fast instrument, but they should look a little deeper at the causes of inequality. And so I think potentially what I propose could be supported both by Democrats and by Republicans. So the deeper question is, how long do new ideas spread to be accepted by the parties? And that, it's hard to say that. Usually, ideas take a lot of time, but it's thanks to people like you that ideas spread faster. And so if you could make it spread faster, maybe we'll see a change within a couple of years.
Well, maybe, but you also teach international law. Is there any country, and obviously not the United States, but have you run into any country that's making progress along these lines that we could look to as an example?
No, in the sense that you have countries where the United States, you see trends 15 years before you see them elsewhere. So also in Europe, you see a tendency towards more marketing. And inequality is a little less, but it's just because they're behind. So in 15 years, it's exactly the same. But I do think, so there is no country that has done this. And one of the reasons is that my proposals are original. So they couldn't implement my proposals before I had written it down.
But fair enough.
Yeah. So but let's hope. I think naturally in France, people like that more or are more open to my suggestions, I think, than at least some people in the United States.
Well, how about in Belgium? Obviously, I was just there. There's still a very large role for the state in Belgium compared to many countries. Is that a place where we might see progress here?
Maybe. I think the critical look at marketing is easier to sell in Belgium because of that culture, the same as in France. Like, if someone makes money, there must something be wrong about it. So that is it. On the other hand, Belgium is not the best environment for entrepreneurship. But the good thing about Belgium is that the taxes are already so high that they cannot redistribute anymore with taxes. So I think maybe my proposals have a good chance there.
You weren't a fan of unions in your book.
No, maybe it's because I'm a law and economics scholar, and in law and economics, we don't like the idea of correcting distortions through other distortions. And so unions, let me make it clear, can be a good second best. Yeah, if nothing else works, you can try unions, and unions indeed can make sure that some people who belong to the lower paid classes then can end up somewhere in the middle. But it's not the first best. I think the first best is just correct a distortion where the distortion happens. So make sure that HP cannot charge $29 for a little bit of ink that should cost $5. Correct it where it exists. It's basically a theorem in law and economics that you should do something about it directly where the problem occurs and not create a new distortion in the hope of canceling out another distortion.
Got you. And Professor, where can people find your book, Rents, How Marketing Causes Inequality?
That's a kind of question. Yeah, you can find it on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble online. There is also an e-book version that you can buy more or less everywhere. The e-book version is $7, and the softcover version is $15. So it's a project that is heavily supported by Washington University. And, that's...
Well, it's been great talking to you, and this is a theory that artificial profits are not good for anybody, at least on the rest of us. So let's hope that Professor DeGeest makes some progress here and that we can help push it along. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud. We say it on the air. We say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.